Welcome to the Farcast, bringing you insights into Wall Street, Washington, and the world. Now here's your host, Michael Farr.
Welcome to the Farcast. I am Michael Farr. Thanks so much for joining us again this week. It is the 8th day of February. You made it through January. You made it through Groundhog's Day. Are you ready for Valentine's Day? Do you feel the love in your heart? That really doesn't matter. You better have some flowers for your sweetheart or you will feel a foot elsewhere. Unpleasantness out there. Let's avoid the unpleasantness, which is going to be my theme for this Farcast today, avoiding the unpleasantness. I will share with you all that on Valentine's Day next week, Mrs. Farr and I are getting a new puppy. Our dog of 13 and a half years passed away over the summer. He was a member of the family, Ripley, a great Labrador retriever, and another one, now 6 months old and partially trained, a Fox Red Lab from Tennessee named Dixie, will arrive and totally turn our lives upside down. So that's going to be my market focus probably next week. My non-market focus, the focus of my golf game and everything else, is going to be Dixie next week as we try and introduce her to the household. Markets are doing great. The economy is doing great. I had three breathless texts and then phone calls from a reporter from a major publication yesterday as to whether the S&P was going to close at or above 5,000. And they were going to have a front page story. And could they quote me and could they call me right at the close if it went over 5,000? I said, no. Quote, I'll give you the quotation right now. They said, wait a minute, it hasn't traded over 5,000. I said, what the hell difference does that make? You think I'm going to change what I'm going to say in 2 hours when it goes over 5,000? I'm going to tell you now. Write this down. Use it if you want to. 5,000. That's amazing on the S&P 500. As I talk to different investors around the country, they're thinking about things that they've missed. They're thinking about the narrow leadership of the wonderful tech stocks. They're thinking about the GLP-1 pharmaceutical drugs that control weight loss. They're thinking about all of these things. And what they're not thinking about is risk. What they don't remember is the last time the market went down 10 or 15% or a real bear market that lasted for months and months and months. Most of them aren't thinking about it because they haven't lived through a real bear market. But this is a time, ladies and gentlemen, as market makes new high after new high, that people become complacent. And they begin to think, well, I'm not worried about the downside, really. Where should I put my money for the upside? When you stop worrying about the downside, ladies and gentlemen, you should start to worry really about the downside because there's always another downside. I don't mean to be the voice of gloom. I am the voice of reason and experience, I promise. And if you don't believe me, we're going to ask my friend Jim Labenthal from Cerity Partners, CNBC contributor, the voice of reason everywhere. Good morning, Jim. So glad to have you with us, and you just chime in and tell everybody where I'm wrong.
Michael, great to see you again. Great to be here with you. Very sorry to hear about Ripley. I hope everything goes well with Dixie, and prepare for
it's an exciting time now. You know, members of the family that we have a friend who says if God made a mistake, it's that our dogs and cats don't live at least 80 years. Really, yeah. You know, it's awful.
Oh. We all know, I would say prepare for much furniture to be chewed to smithereens by the young Dixie that is coming. Yeah. Great intro. So let me just dance with what you're saying. Yes, of course, the markets sometimes go down. And I think you'll agree that we have to distinguish between a correction, which can come at any point in time and probably should with the ridiculousness. I mean, probably should occur at any point in time. That's the normal noise of the random walk down Wall Street. But I think what you may be pointing at is what could make it worse, because you actually used the term bear market. I mean, we don't say that at Polite Company, but we did. Okay. what you know, for a bear market, you have to have something big happen. Now, you know, nominally a recession, that doesn't appear anywhere on the horizon, despite the gloom sayers out there. But, you know what could cause a recession is something unexpected, a shock, the proverbial black swan. And if you ask me where the proverbial black swan could come from, politics, particularly international geopolitics. I mean, the Ukraine war, which is a terrible humanitarian tragedy, continues to just percolate. Now going into its third year, that could get worse if Russia decides to stupidly escalate it instead of trying to find a way to get an off-ramp. Or, you know, China, while I think there's room for their economy to recover, they face some serious issues with youth unemployment and a real estate bust that's pretty dramatic. What if, you know, Xi does a classic wag the dog and takes on Taiwan, crosses the Taiwan Straits just to get his people off of the economic malaise? That's a play out of a well-worn playbook. You know, the Middle East could blow up at any point in time. But now, having said all this about geopolitics, we can talk about domestic politics in a second. I do want to point out that geopolitics have been a risk for as long as I've been alive. I mean, as long as I've been alive, and now the years are starting to pile up. You know, we've had ICBM gaps. We've had Russian shootdowns of Korean airlines over the Kamchatka Peninsula. We've had Iran take the U.S. embassy hostage. I mean, these are just a handful of things, many of which have happened over the last 55 years and will continue to happen. To prophylactically change your investment stance because of a geopolitical risk that might happen has proven to be foolhardy in the past, and I don't recommend it now.
You know, a great list, okay, great list of things that could go wrong, and it's often the things even not on that list that will go wrong, that surprise us. And the one adage on Wall Street you can take to the bank is Wall Street hates to be surprised, hates to be surprised. Doesn't matter what the surprise is. We like to see it coming. Well, wherever that surprise comes from, we have seen higher, 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 higher. It's been wonderful for portfolios. It makes everybody feel warm and fuzzy. You don't need to be beating your index. Yeah, you can trail your index and you're still making money wherever you are out there and your goals. The problem is sentiment, and particularly emotion, is the foe of the long-term investor. Whenever I found myself doing anything based on fear, Jim, when I really made a fear-based decision, either in the management of my business or in my investing, it's typically been a mistake. I mean, it's almost, I hate to say always, but it's been a mistake. And at times when I have just said, I've got to get in, and I've had real FOMO, and I've had it, folks. This has happened to me too, where I've said, I can't not own that anymore. That's been a mistake. Fundamentals, and discipline, dispassionate discipline protect you as an investor. So Jim, tell us what your discipline is having you do right now. And one question I'm asking guests is, are you buying things actively right now? And have you been trimming more than normal?
Yeah, I highly recommend that you hit rewind for 60 seconds and listen again to what Michael just said. Emotion-based decisions are almost always wrong. The odds are way against you if you're acting on fear or exuberance. And, you know, Michael, what you just described is experience from which judgment comes. I think the simplest thing to do right now is to diversify your portfolio. You know, calling a correction or calling an exogenous shock is extremely difficult, bordering on impossible. And I feel quite comfortable that whatever the first month or so of the market has brought this year, that there will be further gains to the end of the year, but there's certainly going to be some volatility as well. I do expect a correction. Folks, don't try to time it. Don't try to time it. You're more likely to get that wrong than you are likely to get it right. But absolutely, to take Michael, let me just continue for a second here. To take what you were just saying, where you would go against the grain of what market sentiment is telling you right now, is to actually diversify your portfolio away from the Mag 7. And I'm not saying, folks, sell all your NVIDIA, sell all your Apple, sell all your Meta. That's not what I'm saying. I am saying that there are a number of companies and industries outside of the Magnificent Seven whose earnings are doing really quite well. And when you compare those earnings growth and their guidance to the share prices, I find it really quite attractive. Now, I'm not going to use specific names. You can go look in these sectors. Look at basic materials. Look at what's happening with the steel stocks. Look at airlines. Look at lodging and casinos. Look at like super discretionary companies like the auto manufacturers. Just go back over the last couple of weeks and look at those earnings reports and the guidance and the verbiage that was given. Again, exogenous shocks can happen at any point in time to knock this guidance down. But right now, it looks pretty darn good in those industries with prices that are a lot more attractive than what you see in the Mag 7, taking nothing away from the Mag 7.
Right. I agree with that. And the economy is expanding. And the I guess the foundation continues to look good, even if we have to go through a period where the Fed adds accommodation. The Fed has even said they're ready to add accommodation this year. We're now quite just talking about the timing of accommodation from the Fed. Usually when the Fed accommodates, that's not, it doesn't feel good. So some pullback is out there, but I think you listen to Labenthal here. Jim, let me give you one thorny issue. You mentioned a stock, and let's not mention a name of a specific stock as we discuss this, but let's just say you have a stock, any stock that goes up 40% in a month, and maybe it's already had a bunch of gains, and you've only owned it for 8 months, and you're looking at taking a short-term big capital gain and paying a full tax income tax rate at your regular normal rate, where if I hang on for 4 months, I really get a pretty good tax cut and pay out just a lower capital gains rate for most people. For higher income people, that's, closer to 40% as opposed to 20%, give or take. And then I haven't included my state taxes yet, but that's just on the federal level. How do you look at that sort of a decision and timing when you're trying to manage a portfolio and your taxes? Because it's a big difference. I mean, that's almost 20% difference in your tax hit.
Well, a few things here. Never let the tax tail wag the dog.
Thank you.
You know, we didn't choreograph this, but we kind of know each other's psyches when it comes to investing. The other thing is, it's the second week of February. I mean, We're 1/6 of the way through the year. Trim the position. You don't have to sell the whole thing, particularly if you like it. But if it's gone up by a gargantuan amount and now it's bigger than it was a month ago, trim a little bit. You've got 9-10 months left in the year to find some tax losses to offset it. And if you get to December and you have no tax losses, bully for you, my friend. This is a high-class problem to have.
It's a great problem to have, but I think this is such an important discussion. But let me take it one just level deeper, and we've got to go. But in the 1970s, we had smiley faces, and the slogan, ubiquitous slogan in marketing was, in the 1970s, late, if it feels good, do it. I mean, it was the post-hippie flower child, if it feels good, do it. It was groovy, baby. And in investing, you do the opposite. There's nothing groovy about investing if done properly, according to Farr. There's the bucket of cold water there. No groovy in investing. And if it feels bad, do it. If it feels bad, do it. So what would feel bad now? If you're owning the Magnificent Seven and patting yourself on the back at all of the damn money you're making, how would you like to sell a little bit of that stock that's on a roll and buy some basic materials? God, does that sound boring? Does that sound, I mean, horrible, horrible. Let's go buy maybe some of the others. Maybe you're going to look at energy stocks. I'm not making recommendations. I'm just trying to think of things that look boring and awful compared to the stuff that's on a roll. Jim, how do you make yourself do it? And we got to go. That's my last question.
Yeah, well, you know, you brought up energy stocks. Take a look at the shareholder returns of these big energy stocks. Take a look at the dividends. Take a look at the share buybacks. That'll get you off your, off the seat and actually taking action there. Again, these don't have to be wholesale changes. Trim and add. Just rebalance your portfolio. You should have some energy in there. You should have some basic materials. I'm not selling sell all your tech stocks and pile it into energy. But what I am saying is, do not be intellectually lazy and think that these Mag 7s, which are shooting through the roof, are justified by their fundamentals. They're not. It's going on sentiment. And what Michael just said about going against the grain of what your sentiment tells you is absolutely right. Again, don't sell the whole things, but trim it. And go to those places that nobody's talking about, but where the shareholder return is tremendous. And the prices as a valuation against earnings are just wonderfully attractive.
Final real important suggestion from Farr. Certainly listen to Labenthal. We always say that. His points were perfectly on. Final suggestion here. Start talking to yourself as an investor, folks. Start talking to yourself and saying, I know the market's going to pull back. I know these stocks are going to come down. Some of those that have gone up the biggest may come down in a dramatic way, and I'm going to get my Pepto-Bismol and keep it right next to my laptop. I've got the Tums ready. I know it goes down. I know it goes down. I know it goes down. Just tell yourself now, get yourself steeled for it, and you will have an advantage over all of those who start screaming and yelling and running around like chickens with their head cut off. Love those guys. You can always make money off of those guys. Jim Labenthal is a partner at Cerity Partners, the greatest CNBC contributor out there. Listen to Labenthal. Thank you, Jim, so much for being with us.
Michael, great to be back with you. And folks, always follow Farr. And I'm telling you, there's a couple of times in this episode where you should rewind and listen to what Michael just said, particularly about emotion.
Emotion kills you, promise. We're going to come back with Dan Mahaffey. From, you ready? The Dr. Scholl Foundation, also still a fellow at the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress. Please stay with us.
Thank you for joining us this week on the Farcast. Now it's time for political analyst Dan Mahaffey and your host, Michael Farr.
Welcome back to the Farcast. I am Michael Farr. It is the eighth day of February, and things are going well on Wall Street, but not so well in Washington. We cover Wall Street, Washington, and the world here on the Farcast. Josh Uminski's coming up for segment three, talking about the world. Joining us now, as he does almost every week, the vice chairman of the Dr. Scholl Foundation and a fellow at the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress, our great Dan Mahaffey, senior political analyst at the Farcast. Welcome back, Dan.
Good morning, Michael. Thank you. Great to be talking with you.
Okay, Dan, I'm going to see if I can get this right. Both Republicans and Democrats, both sides of the aisle, have been very concerned about two things, about closing the Mexican border to all of these illegal immigrants and finding a way to supply funding for Ukraine and Israel. And indeed, the House had a bill on which they agreed that would shut down, have reform and shutting down part of that border, and would provide some funding to Ukraine and Israel. And Donald Trump said, stop, don't do it. Even though Republicans wanted it and Democrats wanted it, he said, don't do it. Because why?
The cynical take on that, the Senate had a compromise crafted by Senator James Lankford, a conservative from Oklahoma, covered a lot of border measures, one of the toughest border deals you have, and frankly, too, something that would change the law. Now, I know a lot of people are talking about what the president can do on his own, but there are a lot of things he could do on his own, don't get me wrong, but a lot of those, one, would be subject to court challenges and wouldn't resolve the matter. And two, this White House is very reluctant to use some executive powers because you don't want to set the precedent of a future president using those powers in a way that could be even more potentially abusive or questionable in policymaking. So there's that they're keeping in mind. Changing the law, as this would have done, would have been the clearest way to do it. And it had a deal, too, to provide funding to Israel, Ukraine, and Taiwan while also securing our border. Senator Lankford probably is now looking at the tire marks on his back from what he probably thought was a bus that ran over him and backed over him again. But I'm frankly calling it a hearse. And it's really the hearse carrying the coffin of the traditional Republican Party as we knew it.
Now, the traditional Republican Party as we knew it. You know, Dan, let's give me a minute on or two on that, because as I talk to Republicans around the country, many will sort of lament that the Republican Party isn't what it was. Many of them independents now will tell me that used to be Republicans will say, I did not leave the Republican Party. The Republican Party left me. It's become the Donald Trump Party. It's become the party of hell no, we won't go, even though we don't seem to have a better place to lead you. I'm not
right. And that was the principles you had here of deal making, trading, legislating, the things that, you know, Reagan talked about. If you can get 80 or 90% in a compromise, you take it. The mindset we have to realize is democracy is a bus. Sometimes you don't get to the destination, but you can get off closer to where you want to be. And to do that, though, requires compromise, negotiation. And this is a party that has shown they're not willing to do it. And the cynical take on that is that Donald Trump doesn't want immigration solved before the election, that he wants it to continue to be an issue. But Democrats will now be able to turn around and say, look, we had a plan to solve this. We had a plan to fix what we're seeing at the border. It wasn't perfect, but it was a step in the direction and solving this crisis. And Republicans chose to have this as a political hot potato rather than fix the problem. So that's what Democrats will be saying. The Republicans, I think, are going to continue to say that, you know, they don't want to make a deal until Biden acts. But I think that's basically a fig leaf for getting to ultimately where their base is, which is a Trump program largely of building a wall, deporting as many people, and the economic and moral consequences be damned.
Okay. Is there anything President Biden, can President Biden issue an executive order to shut the border right now?
He could. A lot of that was done under the public health emergency. You know, that's one of the other things that
a lot of it was done. But we all watched 60 Minutes last weekend and we saw 3,000 Chinese coming through one hole every week in Texas. And
I'm not disputing that this is a crisis and it's a way that can be solved. But the other thing, this legislation, the president can't magically create more border patrol agents. He can't magically pull money towards it like this bill was going to do. That's the problem here. Now, I think the path forward on what we see for some of this, the legislation is still there. I question where we go with a vote on just aid for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan. There's ways that could pass through the House. But right now, the House, as we saw, is such a mess. It's really a wild card on what they can actually get done, short of things like you see, like that tax deal that got through. And I think that's going to probably get through the Senate with some minor modifications. But otherwise, the Speaker, as we saw, is not in control of the very narrow majority that he has.
Tell us quickly about the tax bill that got through, please. Quickly.
So what they have done is look to fix some of the things that were going to expire with the previous cuts. They've extended tax credit. I think they're continuing. From what I hear, the details, though, are still on the matters of can they fix the SALT deductions, things like that.
Yeah. Dan, as we look at Capitol Hill, what sort of progress can we see between now and the election if things are so divided over making sure that the other guy doesn't get a political advantage by an inch?
Yeah. I think they still got to get these spending deals done. So we're looking to see where progress is on that because you want to avoid the dreaded year-long CR or the risk of another shutdown. But, you know, they'll need to get pushed closer to the deadline to do that. And then from there, I think we wonder what some of the basic things like defense bills, stuff like that. Look, there's ways, though, that the, you know, Ukraine-Israel aid could pass. There's ways that the Democrats could work with moderate Republicans to get that done. Discharge petitions, it'll take some time. But they're kind of having to learn on the fly how to rework a house that isn't working.
Rework a house that isn't working. I don't know where they go with that or how they manage to do it.
You have to do a lot of those things, as we saw, the discharge petition or working on the suspension of the rules, but that requires a 2/3 vote to do anything in the House.
Continuing resolution in order to keep funding. All of these things aren't going away, and all of these things just continue to frustrate the American public. Moving on, I just want to go directly to the Middle East. We're about out of time, Dan. I apologize here. We've got 2 minutes. Let's see what we can do here. I'm seeing criticism for Secretary Blinken being too nice, being too kind. I feel, from everything I read, that Secretary Blinken knows exactly what he's doing in representing President Biden's administration in basically trying to say the right humanitarian things, bring about the right sort of, he's saying sort of all the nice words, but about stopping, this attack, stopping the war, doing this, doing that, with no intention of providing any teeth for it, letting this particular attack on Hamas go as long as possible, let essentially our proxies own most of it, have us swap back at the Houthis as we can. And there was an attack overnight, of course, where it was one single missile that hit one single car in Baghdad and killed a senior Iranian leader who's accused, and apparently we knew was helping all of these basically terrorist groups around the Middle East. What's going on? Is this just all show? Are we willing to let, and how does Israel stop this? Because when do you know that you've done what you
need? I question the Israeli strategy of knowing when they want to stop this. We saw the Wall Street Journal headline that probably more hostages are dead right now. There's the, some in the Defense Department would say from a military calculus, you've killed Hamas leaders, but also the IDF has killed more hostages than they've rescued. The ones that we have gotten released have come through diplomatic efforts like Blinken is doing. And part of it, I think, is one, a recognition of just how limited our leverage is with the extremists that Netanyahu has in government. I don't know what more the secretary could do, because we got into the cynicism of Netanyahu trying to hold on to power and the parties he needs to help him do that. I think, though, the administration actually does need to change their tone on this and become tougher, because do the math on losing Wisconsin by how many votes from students in Madison. How many votes are you going to lose in Ann Arbor and Dearborn, Michigan now? These are areas where among young people, among the Muslim American community, Israel is not seen as the victim anymore. They're seen as the aggressor. And that is something where the domestic politics of Israel are changing in not just demographic ways, but generationally. And that's something the administration has to consider, because what we saw just recently, and not one factor is tied to it, but Democrats now have their lowest rating among young people since the 90s. And that's something they're very worried about going into an election where, if you looked at 2020, young people and their turnout were critical to defeating the greater turnout that Trump saw.
The human tragedy and the suffering in the Middle East by innocence cries to heaven. There is no question. And it breaks my heart in what happened in Israel and what happens as still happening in Palestine. The innocent death everywhere around the world, whether in Ukraine and elsewhere, it's the worst.
And I think that's the contrast a lot of Americans are beginning to see, is that Ukraine, Taiwan are places that are fighting for their freedom, but in the in the Middle East, these people have been fighting for millennia before us, seem to want to fight for millennia after us, and why are we spending billions in blood and treasure there?
The one thing, and that I hope this sounds like a contradiction, but the one thing that I've admired many things about Israel over the years, but one thing I've admired about Israel is that if you go after Israel, you can count on Israel responding, and you can count on Israel coming to kick your ass, and not just a little. They have always been extremely clear that whatever you think normal retribution is, you're going to get more. Nobody messes with Israel and thinks this is going to be an easy kind of a swat at the bear. No, they're coming after you. I've always admired that response. And that isn't to say that I don't hate what I see happening to human lives. But Israel was attacked first. They were attacked and mercilessly. I don't know what to make of it, Dan, but boy, I wish it could be over and resolved, and I wish Secretary Blinken the best. Finally, Dan, I see dead people, the line from that wonderful movie. Apparently, President Biden had a talk with Chancellor Kohl recently and President Mitterrand. Both have been dead for a long time. These are gaffes that the president's made. How long can the Democrats continue to support a president who sees dead people? And I'm being facetious, of course. I mean,
well, I think it's as long as we're debating between the president who misrecognizes European leaders versus the one who doesn't understand a peaceful transfer of power, between a rock and a hard place.
We'll leave it there. Dan Mahaffey, the vice chairman of the Dr. Scholl Foundation, fellow at the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress, the senior political analyst on the Farcast. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you, Michael. Great to talk to you.
Josh Uminski, when we come back, ladies and gentlemen, more world events and Washington and how it all gets back to Wall Street. Please stay with us.
Michael Farr and the Farcast are proud to support Heroes, Inc. Heroes supports the spouses and children of law enforcement officers and firefighters who gave their lives in the line of duty to the greater Washington, D.C. community. Their singular goal is to honor the supreme sacrifice made by these individuals by caring for their families. Heroes' work begins within 24 hours of the tragic loss and continues indefinitely. We invite you to learn more about Heroes' mission at heroes.org. We hope that you will consider supporting Heroes as they endeavor to honor those who protect us. That's heroes.org. Heroes, here for you, here for good. And now, back to the Farcast and your host, Michael Farr.
We appreciate you listening into the Farcast this week. And now to introduce this week's special guest, here's your host, Michael Farr.
Welcome back. Thanks so much for being with us again this week on the Farcast. Josh Uminski is director of the Mike Rogers Center for Intelligence and Global Affairs at the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress, a frequent lecturer all over Washington, D.C. and around the country. He is an expert on intelligence and securities studies around the world. Josh, thanks so much for being with us again on the Farcast.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here after the first of the year.
Well, we're glad to have you here. Certainly lots to talk about with Ukraine and the Middle East and China and the Mexican border and everything else. What are the hottest spots on your mind right now? We've covered a bunch so far. I have this notion that the soft soap kind of language, seeming language coming from our Secretary of State on the Middle East and in Israel, maybe not sounding tough enough, might be sending exactly the right the message that the Biden administration wants, which is we're going to talk a good act, but let Israel go in and see if they can actually get rid of Hamas for us. Start there and tell me what you think about that, and then let's go to your hot spots.
Well, certainly. I mean, I think if we take a step back, we're looking at an environment where it's a strategic poly crisis. You know, we go around the world, we look at Ukraine, Russia, we look at the Middle East, the Red Sea, we look at the Indo-Pacific and China and Taiwan. There's no shortage of crises. But if we look at specifically the situation in Israel, I have to reflect at the fact that there is no theory of victory for Israel right now. You know, Netanyahu rejected the proposed truce or ceasefire that Hamas put on the table in exchange for the hostages, saying that they are close to victory, but there is no clear identification of what that victory means. They are pushing south, potentially going to get to Rafah, which is the border crossing with Egypt, compressing the Palestinian people down there and their pursuit of Hamas. And the expectation that they can totally root out Hamas, I think, is ambitious to say the least. But then the question is, can you actually do that? I'm skeptical. And then what comes the day after, which is even less discussed right now? So Netanyahu, I think, is playing to a domestic base, trying to respond, and understandably so, for the events of the 7th of October. But there is no theory of victory for Israel in the Gaza Strip right now.
How do they know when they're done? I'm sorry to beat a dead horse here. I think you've just told me they don't, and they won't know when they're done. There's got to be some point, though, where the last tunnel has been flooded and they don't, I mean, is there a point where they go, got them?
There could well be, as you said, you know, if that tunnel is flooded and they say that they got them, you know, put up the mission accomplished banner and walk away. The problem is what comes the day after? And that's where I don't think that certainly Israel has given much thought or any thought to it, because you're going to have a massive humanitarian crisis on your border. You're going to have political instability within the Gaza Strip. You're going to have economic destruction and devastation. There's no plan for what comes next. And if you're looking to truly root out the sources of conflict and crisis which led to the events of October the 7th, you're going to need to have a plan for reconstruction, rehabilitation, and political reconstitution. Now, what Blinken has been doing, the Secretary of State, in terms of his shuttle diplomacy across the region, is trying to marshal countries like Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Egypt, and others to reach some sort of accord for a long-term plan. Now, certainly Blinken sees this as an inflection point, certainly like the 67 war and the 73 Yom Kippur war, to realign the politics of Israel. But Netanyahu does not see that, and politically and domestically, I don't think can really afford to lean into those proposals, however much those proposals, the credibility therein can be given. But we're going to have to see what happens. And I don't think that there is going to be that clear, you know, mission accomplished moment right now.
Is this still going on a year from now, Josh?
I think something is going to be going on a year from now. Now, what that looks like, the instability, I should say, will continue, full stop, until the underlying
circumstances resolve. Okay, how about the involvement of Iran?
Iran is going to be involved through its proxy forces. It's going to be backing, you know, the so-called axis of resistance.
Do we go in, do we end up directly in conflict with Iran?
I hope not. I think the risks for escalation are certainly there, and to dismiss them out of hand would be reckless. Now,
what I can't understand, and I'm sorry, Josh is really great, by the way, as a guest, ladies and gentlemen, because he sees me start to talk and he stops talking, which is what most guests don't do, and probably shouldn't, really, because they're making better points than I am. But Josh, I've asked this before on the Farcast, because this has been making me crazy for the last 50 years of my life. I wasn't concerned about Iran up until the age of 10 or 12 years old. After that, which was 50 years ago, I was, because we had the Iran hostage crisis that Jimmy Carter had to deal with. I had all of this stuff. Every time we've turned around, Iran has been doing something, to the United States. They've been in some either active or passive battle, trying to create nukes and everything else. When are we going to do something more decisive with Iran? And why are we still putting up with this torment?
I think the supposition that underlies that question is that there is something that can be done about Iran.
Yes.
The reality is that it is about managing successive crises and trying to reach the best possible situation and stability therein. There is no solution to Iran. You're not going to invade and marshal the way to Tehran like some of the more hawkish individuals in the neoconservative movement at one point wanted, and I'm sure still do. There is no winning in that conflict. The reality is it's going to be about management of the successive crises, being examples, the use of proxy forces throughout the region. That is an example. The attempt to constrain, limit, and prevent Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. That's another example. The Iranian relationship with Russia and supplying of munitions, like the Shahid drone, to Russia, which is being used in Ukraine. That's another example. Iran is certainly a destabilizing force within the region and more globally. But the supposition that we can do something about it within a appropriate cost and risk of regional conflagration, I don't think so. I think it's about managing policy and trying to manage the risks of escalation therein.
Okay. All right. Let's move then to Ukraine. So we're just going to keep trying to manage this. We're going to be doing it a year from now, and there's no clear way to say victory. Move to Ukraine and what this means to the U.S., because I'm talking to people around the country. This is my speech-giving time of the year. People want an economic forecast and everything, and I am chock-a-block with speeches. I'll be at the University of Delaware giving the economic forecast with the Philly Fed President Pat Harker at the University of Delaware. The next day, I have to be in Miami at a 2 o'clock speech for the World Economic Forum for YPO, for the Young Presidents Organization, and whatever the graduate thing is, YPO Gold or something like that now. I have a speech next week in Vero Beach, Florida, a few hundred people at a dinner speech. I'm really rolling around. And the thing they're asking me, people saying, why do we have to keep going into Ukraine? Why are we spending our money there? Why does this matter to American interests? There's a big protectionist feeling like we've got problems here. We've got problems on our southern border in Mexico. We don't have funding there. And why are we sending billions of dollars over to Ukraine? Why do we care if Russia takes Ukraine? Let Russia go all the way to Poland. What does that matter to United States interests?
Well, I'm going to unpack it from the beginning there. So when we talk about the billions of dollars in aid that are going to Ukraine, over 60% of that is coming straight back to the United States and American defense industries. We're not just cutting blank checks and sending it over to Ukraine. So that is a mischaracterization that the administration has done quite poorly about presenting to the American people. But putting the money to this side, the risks that Ukraine falls to Russia and Russia conquers Ukraine has significantly reduced. The likelihood that Moscow is going to be marching on Kyiv is almost non-existent at this point without a significant and substantial change within Russia, which is unlikely to happen, certainly ahead of March's presidential election, but certainly thereafter as well. For the American people, why this fundamentally matters is it comes down to American leadership and American upholding of the liberal international system, which has provided the prosperity and growth and stability that we've enjoyed from the end of the Second World War through the Cold War to today. If we allow Russia to take Ukraine,
yes,
to insert instability within the European continent, it sends a significant and undermining signal to any would-be aggressor or predator. We look to China and Taiwan, for example, which is going to increase stability. If we do not act here, and there are not Americans on the ground, this is American weapons and American dollars achieving the best bang for the buck that you're going to get in terms of materially degrading the conventional forces of Russia. If we don't do something here, if
yes,
we do not hold the line here,
yes,
we're going to see a significant destabilizing effect more globally. And certainly we look to Taiwan and China being a great example there. So for the American people to understand why this matters,
yes,
to global stability. This matters to global economic prosperity and growth, and this matters to American leadership. Because what we're seeing right now is in the absence of American leadership and the absence of clarity in American leadership, you have an aggressive Kremlin that is acting in Ukraine. And oh, by the way, they're also acting further afield and spreading mis and disinformation throughout Africa to undermine America's position. They are spreading mis and disinformation and propaganda and intelligence efforts throughout the European continent to erode continental stability. We look to what the Houthis are doing in terms of supporting Hamas and attacking Red Sea shipping, was ostensibly to target Israeli shipping, which they're really not. They're just targeting anything to hurt Israel via the United States. If we don't hold the line here, we look at an aggressive President Xi in Beijing looking to Taiwan to potentially offset his own domestic political and economic weaknesses. And so we have this global instability that has a material impact on the American people and America's position in the world.
Josh, I'm going to I've only got 2 minutes. So I'm going to make you the president of the United States right now. I'm going to make you president of the United States. And let me tell you what just happened. Every listener went, oh, thank God. Oh, thank God. Anybody. And this kid sounds smart. So for God's sakes, what a great idea, Farr. So, I mean, it's a low bar, right? Sorry, I'm trying to pay you a compliment. It's still a low bar.
I'll still take the compliment nonetheless.
Right? Okay, so you're president of the United States. President Huminsky, what would be the first three or four things you would do in the next week, domestically and internationally, Ukraine, Israel, anywhere, Mexican border? What do you do to safeguard the interests of the United States?
I think first and foremost, we need to significantly increase weapons production across the board. There's a major investment in America's defense industrial base to rearm ourselves. If we look at what we're firing off in the Red Sea, but also what we're providing to Europe and providing to Ukraine, that's going to send a huge signal to Russia and China alike that we are doubling down and we are looking forward to the long term, investing in our military, investing in our shipbuilding industry, and seriously doubling down on that. So big, big, big investments in the military and defense industrial base and smart investments in defense industrial base. I think on the southern border in particular, you know, we need to have a serious conversation about immigration reform, but we cannot talk about immigration reform until we secure the border first and foremost. They go in parallel, but they have to happen together. And that'll offset a lot of the criticism from the right.
Yep.
And understandably so, we do that. And I think, again, we need to really lean forward, and this is probably my third priority here, is getting Europe to meet the 2% NATO GDP spending requirements, if not exceeding it. Because if we can get European countries, many of which are, but not all of them are doing so, to meet their spending requirements and thresholds, we are going to be able to, again, offset the criticism about what the United States doing in Ukraine, but also allow us to pivot to the Indo-Pacific more clearly.
Okay, two things, ladies and gentlemen. One, how'd I do, huh? Did I pick the right guy for president? Was that, don't you feel better? I mean, wouldn't you love him to be in the White House right now? I'm telling you, I picked a very good president. So maybe we call off the election and just let Farr pick the president. I said years ago, we should just hire Goldman Sachs to do it because we end up with half of their people anyway, and we could outsource it and just pay them for about half the price that we have to pay once we actually get these people in there with control of a budget. The other thing that I want to just bring to your attention, ladies and gentlemen, my dear listeners, thousands and thousands of you, thank you so much for listening. Think about getting that question yourself. What would be the first three things you would do if I made you president of the United States tomorrow? What would be the first three things you would do? I'm going to suggest that most normal people would say, you know, maybe learn to hum hail to the chief, read off a teleprompter. I don't know what is exactly the person. Those were three excellent answers, off the top of his head to advance the cause, well-being, safety of the United States. Terrific, Josh Uminski. Josh Uminski is the director of the Mike Rogers Center for Intelligence and Global Affairs, Center for the Study of the Presidency in Congress. A brilliant guy, a great friend of the Farcast. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me. I look forward to coming back again soon.
We look forward to having you. Ladies and gentlemen, that's it for another Farcast as we cover Wall Street, Washington, and the world. Every guest we've had today has talked to you about the economic impact, how these things are going to affect our economy and Wall Street. Think about what would happen to those defense stocks if President Uminski really starts spending the way he says he's going to start to spend. And by the way, think about how our border would be secured and the money we might be able to save there, and how a more stable world is a more profitable, prosperous world that lifts even the poorest among us to a better quality of life. It's not just all about the rich people, folks. We're going to do it again next week. Wall Street, Washington, and the world. For Harry Jennings, our producer, for Farr Miller in Washington, everybody at Hightower Advisors, thanks so much for being a listener, for being a subscriber. Our newsletter every week is free. hjennings@farrmiller.com. He'll put you on the list. Thanks so much, everybody. I'll be back next week. I'm Michael Farr. Bye.
And that's a wrap for this week's episode of the Farcast. Michael will be traveling in the coming weeks, but we are planning on continuing weekly episodes through the winter and into spring as we continue Season 7. Thanks to this week's guests, Jim Labenthal, Dan Mahaffey, and Joshua Uminski. Michael will be appearing at the University of Delaware's annual economic forecast alongside President of the Philadelphia Federal Reserve Bank, Patrick Harker, on February 22nd. If you would like to attend, you can search for Lerner Business School Economic Forecast or just email me at hjennings@farrmiller.com, and I'll be happy to send you information on how you can reserve your tickets and see Michael, President Harker, and others share their insights into the evolving economic situation. If you would like to subscribe to Michael's weekly commentary, again, please reach out to me at hjennings@farmiller.com. I'll be happy to add you to the mailing list. The Farcast is produced by Michael Farr and Harry Jennings and comes to you weekly for free on all major podcast platforms, including Google, Spotify, TuneIn, and Apple Podcasts. You can stream past episodes as well as subscribe so you never miss a new show. Take care, stay safe, and stay healthy. Thanks for listening to the Farcast, Wall Street, Washington, and the world. Farr, Miller & Washington is a group comprised of investment professionals registered with Hightower Advisors, LLC, an SEC-registered investment advisor. Some investment professionals may also be registered with Hightower Securities, LLC, member FINRA and SIPC. Advisory services are offered through Hightower Advisors, LLC. Securities are offered through Hightower Securities, LLC. All information referenced herein is from sources believed to be reliable. Farr, Miller & Washington and Hightower Advisors, LLC have not independently verified the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this podcast. Farr, Miller & Washington and Hightower Advisors, LLC and any of its affiliates make no representations or warranties, expressed or implied, as to the accuracy or completeness of the information or for statements or errors or omissions or results obtained from the use of this information. Farr, Miller & Washington and Hightower Advisors, LLC and any of its affiliates assume no liability for any action made or taken in reliance on or relating in any way to the information. This podcast and the materials contained herein were created for informational purposes only. The opinions expressed are solely those of the authors and do not represent those of Hightower Advisors, LLC or any of its affiliates. Farr, Miller & Washington and Hightower Advisors, LLC or any of its affiliates do not provide tax or legal advice. This material was not intended or written to be used or presented in any way to any entity as tax or legal advice. Clients are urged to consult their tax and/or legal advisors for related questions.